4 years since we actually decided in Africa.
For my wife and I went to live in Africa.
After being back with some farmers a year or two, we went to live there in 2004. Well, we took all our worldly possessions, such as they were worth. We never thought we'd ever come back again. But the Lord brought us back again. You know a lot about that, so I don't want to talk about that tonight. And the Lord has been opening some amazing doors in other places, and still is. We really appreciate that. And it was wonderful that Helen was able to be over here for a little time last month. She was up today for a review, for a checkup of herself and her condition and the bloods and all the rest. And she got a 99.9% good report. It was one little figure they said had dropped it in, of course. They said it was still inside normal limits. But, you know, when you've come through what she has come through, you know, normal has to be something very new. And so she was on the phone with me and she said, you know, just pray everything's okay. And I said, well, you know, it is okay. And I know it's okay. And the Lord knows it's okay. And she said, yeah, but we just get here. And so keep her in your prayers. She really enjoyed her time here. And she was very disappointed that she had to go home and wasn't able to go to Paris. And she heard about how blessed we had been the time in Paris. She was even more sorry that she hadn't been here. So you can pray for that. I don't think she'll be able to come in October, because her youngest girl, Sarah, who's getting married in September, has a little medical problem that has to have surgery. I can't say any more than that. It's not sinister. But because she is a nurse herself, they said they could push her up to this and bring it forward. So the dear soul gets married on the 19th of September and has to go to the hospital for surgery 2 weeks after she gets married. So her mom said, I want to be here for Sarah in the month of October. I understand that absolutely perfect. Acts chapter 1 and verse number 8. The disciples in context had asked the Lord Jesus, will you go to restore the kingdom? Which maybe was not a particularly intelligent question on their part. They should have learned by this stage, at the end of the 40 days of post-resurrection ministry, that the Lord was not going to restore the kingdom, at least in its previous form at this point in time. But the Lord is always gracious. He said, ye shall receive power. That is the power word, where the previous time power is mentioned as authority. The two things go together. Ye shall receive power. After that, the Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit has come upon you, ye shall be witnesses unto me, both in Jerusalem, and in all Judea, and in Samaria, and unto the uttermost parts of the earth. As William Tyndale said in his very lovely first translation from Greek to English, even unto the end of the world. That's a lovely thought, isn't it? And there's a sense in which what we have here in the words of the Lord Jesus actually is the analysis of the book of Acts. Ye shall be witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea. That's probably about chapters 1 to 7. And then the center section probably from chapter 8 through to about chapter 13. And then Samaria. And then from chapter 13 to the conclusion and to the uttermost parts of the world. There's actually a great thing for the book of Acts contained within what the Lord Jesus Christ himself said to his disciples. Matthew 28 for a contrasting verse. 28:18, Jesus came and spake unto them, saying, all power, that's the other word, that's the authority word. All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, or make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded or charged you. Lo, I am with you all the days, even unto the consummation of the age, or as the King James says, even unto the end of the world. Amen. What I was enjoying there was the contrast in those two commissioning statements of the Lord Jesus. That in the age in which we live, which is what we call the age of grace, or more properly, the acceptable year of the Lord. The Lord Jesus said the gospel would go forth to the ends of the world. And he said the gospel would be proclaimed until the end of the age. Sometimes we get discouraged. We think that the gospel has become a difficult subject, and we struggle to understand how to present it, and there's not many that are interested and want to listen. That's true. But that means we're getting our eye on the wrong thing.
Because what we can rely on is the person of Christ, the Father that already given to us, the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God, the fellowship that we have with the Holy Spirit when we go out with the gospel into the public arena, because He is out there Himself seeking for sinners. And the Lord Jesus said, and we have the authority of His commission, that until the conclusion of the age, the gospel will be successful. It will leave a heart. It will go to the very end of the world. And don't forget, the end of the world began at Jerusalem and went out to all the corners. When you get away up the terrace, and then you hear about little assemblies away up in Anchorage, you think really that's not far from the end of the world compared to Jerusalem. When you think about Cape Town and some of the assemblies away down there, I'm not going to talk about Cape Town tonight, I preached in the most southerly assembly in Africa. By the grace of God, I have preached in the most northerly assembly in the UK. I've possibly been in the most northerly assembly in BC. I haven't yet got to the most northerly assembly in Canada, and the will of the Lord hasn't come. And of course, the most northerly assembly in the US is not down there in Washington, it's up there in Alaska, because our friends from down there managed to get a little bit of up there and call it the last state of America. So, it's probably the last assembly in America. That's up there somewhere. Probably the last assembly in South America. I'll probably never get there. The most northerly assembly in Africa. Well, that's in Cairo. I'm in Cairo. I know somebody has been there. The most southerly assembly in Africa, I've been there. Over on the far east, well, I don't know much of the details of the assembly there. Some of my friends have recently been to preach the gospel in China. Now, maybe Brother David could tell us where the most northerly assembly in that massive area. It's probably a little group that meets maybe even privately, no public awareness whatsoever. But the gospel has been promised to go to the end of the world. And it will get there before the end of the age, because the gospel will also go to the end of the age. Every tongue, and kindred, and people, and language, and nation. There is not one ethnic group or dialect. I was discussing that with some Zambian friends coming up the terrace recently. There is not one ethnic group or subgroup or dialect in which the gospel will not be preached before the end of the age. And I believe in my heart there will be among each group a response. That there will not be one sub-ethnic group in heaven that there will not be a representative of, even in the body of Christ. I do believe that with all my heart. Now let's come to say one or two things about what I have been doing recently in the Lord's work. We move the slide on another one. You probably were expecting to see Europe and North America and Africa and one or two other things up there. I put this together recently because, well, it was my honeymoon. You see, the reality is that nobody, listen now. Because you say, Brother, you're the missionary. And Brother Dave, and then 2 days. And the rest of us are a little bit, no difference whatsoever really when it comes to the propagation of the gospel. You see, nobody has been sent. Nobody. With the exception of the Holy Spirit, who is a person, nobody has been sent everywhere. That's impossible. But let me tell you something else, dear young believer, older believer, dear saint, dear ordinary member of the assembly in Kamloops. No, we're all extraordinary. Nobody has been sent nowhere. So if this continent was entitled nowhere, you would say, well, nobody has been sent to nowhere. You see, nobody has been sent nowhere. And by the grace of God and the authority and power vested in the Spirit of God, anybody could be sent anywhere. And if you never have moved your domicile address for the whole of your life, you know what, dear soul, you've still been sent somewhere. Everybody in this room tonight has got an address, a physical one. A place where you live, neighbours on either side and across the street. And that means you have a testimony. And your testimony can be the stepping stone to the propagation of the gospel. And you can go across the street. If you invite the neighbour opposite and the neighbour on either side, that's three candles. And if you persist, make a great nuisance of yourself, but in a nice way. If that's your mission thing, then tell you this and that. And we're not far away from hoping that the gospel is coming in a formal way again to Kamloops. I'm going back home to Ireland in 2 weeks' time, and it will only be at that point in time 7 weeks until we come back again to join together in preaching in the will of the Lord. I want you to remember these steps. that every single one of us has been commissioned with the authority and power of the risen Christ and the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God, that we are propagators of the gospel and missionaries of the gospel of the grace of God. And that's a big thing for us to focus on and think about, Andrew. Technology has a wonderful habit of misbehaving. I don't know what is going on here. I'm looking at Jason because he's supposed to be the guy that knows. I mean, at least I can plead ignorance when it comes to these things. It's not my line of expertise at all. My screen's still working. What? That's very strange. I mean, the other thing was behaving exceedingly badly. That's why I went and got my own. Do you think it's coming on again? Well, something's happening. It must have shut down. Get that away from there. I don't like water near that stuff. It might come back, but I'll tell you, I'll talk a little bit until it recovers itself. I was going to say a little bit about our movements on the map. It might come back and it might not, so it's not important. As you know, we were in Botswana and South Africa for a number of years, and then because of Helen's illness, we were relocated back to our place of origin. In fact, the Lord was very gracious, for we got back even to our commending home assembly. That was very precious. And we finished up back in fellowship in the assembly in which that we had been in before we went to the Lord's work. Something is coming here, so we'll wait to see what happens. And in the last 4 years, well, 1 year, I suppose, to be very honest, 1 year really was, I don't know if it was missionary work, but it certainly was the Lord's work. It probably took a whole year that I was looking after my wife. Taking care of her in hospital, sitting with her in hospital, looking after her needs in hospital, and then helping to manage her recovery. And that took a long time. And it took the most of 2014. And then, at the end of 2014, I have no idea what's happened now. Because that's my home screen. It's not my PowerPoint. Okay, there we go. See, when Jason stands up, it's like the machinery knows that he knows, and the machinery knows that I don't know. You know, so all he has to do is approach, and then the thing says, I better behave, because there's a guy who knows what he's doing. And the other guy who's up here doesn't know at all. So, well, that date was 3rd of October 2013. That was the date of my wife's diagnosis. And in her diagnosis, and in the onset of her illness, we thought we had lost a lot. We lost the fellowship, the close fellowship of some very special friends. Some dear saints that I would love to see, and maybe in this world, maybe we'll never get to see them again. We lost all our material possessions, and you know what, we discovered very quickly that meant for nothing. Because we were not in a position to repatriate our possessions. The landlord allowed us to break our lease and get out of the house without any penalty. That was very good of them. There was a Christian lady in the landlord's office, and that made the difference. I said to her, listen, I'm not coming back, and I can't keep the house. I need to get out. She said, listen, Dave, don't say another thing. We've been praying for your wife at 7 o'clock in the morning in our office. I didn't say you shouldn't be doing that because you don't go to the hospital hall. I'll tell you this, when my wife was in the middle of her chemotherapy and illness, I didn't really mind who prayed for her as long as they were genuine. And they were very good to us, but at the same time we were not able to get our possessions brought back to Ireland. So I live in a house that belongs to my son, and I sit in a chair that belongs to my son, and well, I suppose the knives and forks are actually his as well, so that's not really important. So since that time then, I've been busy a little bit back in Africa. I'm going to talk about Africa now in a minute. But what I want you to understand is I'm not trying to say or promote the fact that I'm an African missionary, if there is such a thing, or even a white missionary in Africa. Because this trip this year, January, February, March this year, 3 months, was probably exceptional. It was certainly the longest period that I'd been in Africa in 5 years. And there was a whole lot of reasons why both my wife and myself and some of those that I labored with when I was there really were of the opinion the Lord was doing extra special things of a fairly unique category. I've also been working quite a significant part of my time because it was close to home when the Lord opened doors up in the highlands and islands of the northern part of Scotland, and the wise and uncivilized parts of Scotland, which are the best parts, and then just where the H is, the little islands that are based between Scotland and Norway, the Orkneys and the Shetlands. I've been up there quite a few times, and in fact I'll be going there in the month of August, immediately after I go home from here. I've also been working a bit in the southwest of Ireland over here, and again the Lord has been gracious in allowing me to work there, a very needy Roman Catholic area, and within 5 hours of my door, so I was able to drive down there and stay for a day or two and come home. And then of course, as you know, the Lord in great grace has allowed us to be, well, tiptoeing about and doing one or two things in different parts of this mighty province of BC. So I'm going to say a little bit now about my trip to Africa, and then if time permits I'll maybe just show a couple of pictures of the islands of Scotland, because I'm going to be there in August, and maybe I'll show you a couple of slides of the southwest of Ireland where I have been working a lot in the past 4 years. I've already been there this year. I was there before I went to Africa. I want to talk mostly tonight about Botswana and Zambia. That I was working, I was showing these pictures up in Terrace actually. We had a missionary talk in Terrace last Lord's Day, and the saints up there were greatly excited because I was showing the whole town of two of the saints in fellowship in the assembly in Terrace. If you read the assembly list, you'll see that the correspondent is a brother called Whitney Lukuku. So you can guess that he's a first generation Canadian, let's put it that way. And his wife said, you know, she said, Whitney, but I'm really a Canadian. He said, darling, I could cut your accent with a chainsaw. And so you could, because she still just talks like an African. We had a lovely time. Whitney and Margaret both come from an area up here where you see that closer. So they were most excited. And I was in most of Botswana as well on the recent trip, not in South Africa. I have been back there a little bit. We were domiciled away down here in Cape Town. We also lived for a time up here in Francistown. So my missionary territory when I lived in Africa was all of Namibia, two-thirds of Zambia, all of Zimbabwe, all of Botswana, and probably two-thirds of South Africa. I traveled all of that. That's why my old African Land Rover has got 570,000 kilometres on the clock. So you see, distance in BC is not really an issue at all. It is for an Irishman. I talk to my friends in Ireland and they say, well, I leave Kamloops, I want to break bread and fellowship with a like-minded assembly. It takes me 14, 15 hours of driving to get to Terrace, and then their eyes glaze over. And somebody said to my wife, she said, where's David gone now? Oh, she said, he's gone to Terrace. And they said, how far is Terrace? Where is that? Helen says, I think it's about maybe 1,600 kilometres away from where I left him. Oh, he said, that's like driving from London to Jerusalem. Well, so it probably is. Well, anyway, it
doesn't feel like that when you're here. I left Ireland in the month of January, Justin. This is normal kind of weather here, but when you show that to friends in Africa, they get very amused because they think in Ireland it just rains all the time. So it often does, though they've had a tremendous heat wave this year. You get off the plane in Africa and the weather conditions have changed tremendously, and then you fly up to where I normally step off, because my dear brother Dan Galuka, who's been my co-worker, he's a Zambian full-time worker and he works in Botswana, so he's an expatriate commended servant of the Lord amongst the assemblies. His status is no different to ours whatsoever, even though his face is as black as coal. And my own, where he has been based for the last number of years, as you can see, is dry and dusty and barren. And there is a little assembly up there in Mahon. The assemblies in Botswana are six. The assembly in Mahon and the Okavango Delta, where Dan and Stella are based. And the assembly in Francistown, that's 700 kilometres. That's not too far, you see, in Canadian terms. The assembly in Francistown, where we were based for 6 years, there is an English couple called Bandy who are based there as well. An assembly over in Salibi Peakway, and I'll say a little bit about that very quickly at the end. I want you to pray for a brother who's there, and so I'll mention that again. A little assembly down in Palapi where the rackets are. An assembly over here in Soroe, the original assembly in Botswana where Jim and Irie Legg, the first missionaries, they're home on a short furlough, and they've been there for 50 years. And then Havaroni, the capital where the 6th Assembly is, and there's an Irish couple called Logan and an English girl called Griffiths, not Griffin, Griffiths, and single girl, and they're based down in Habaroni. So now Habaroni going this way to Mahon is 1200k. Now Habaroni going this way to Mahon is about 1300. Francistown to Mahon is about 700, and Francistown up to the Zambian border is about 700. So you can see that in Africa they're used to distances just like Canada. The Canadian roads are probably some of the best maintained in the world. Don't take that for granted, because I'm not just talking about Africa. We've got to the stage in the UK because of the breakdown in economics and politics that the UK roads look like African roads. My wife, when she came to Canada, said, I never have seen smooth tarmac like this for a long time. I come home from Africa to Ireland, I drive around potholes. I don't mean that you should feel sorry for us. I'm just saying that the West is degenerating terribly. And the economy and the infrastructure of the UK is disintegrating at a tremendous rate. And big things that I think are prophetic are going to happen in Europe and the western part of the world very soon. That will be a typical road in Botswana. It will probably be nearly as good as it gets. The tarmac is getting a little bit eaten up and chewed away, not by the burning sun, but by the flash floods that arrive every so often, and the water actually seeps down from the Angolan highlands the whole way through the Okavango. It comes down sort of on a northwest-southeast trajectory, and by the time it gets across the road and lies there for a couple of months, when it goes away again, part of the tarmac has disappeared as well. My first set of meetings when I went out in the month of January were in Francistown. Whenever we left the Assembly in Francistown in 2009, and they recommended us to the one of the assemblies in Cape Town, the brethren in Francistown, because I already had been travelling a lot in the surrounding countries, very itinerant, all my days in Africa, so itinerant ministry is not a new thing to me. And the elders, the African elders in Francistown, they said, brother, we don't mind commending you to another country, and through the grace of God, and to another assembly, don't forget Francistown and don't leave us behind. Now the only year since, that was 2009 in August when we left Francistown, the only year since that I have not had a series of meetings in Francistown was 2014. And that was the year that I spent in hospital with my wife. I was back there again in 15, I was back in 16, I was back in 17, and I was there in the month of January 18. They requested these, we somehow or other get the impression that when you step into the African continent you turn down the gas. You know, you pitch the whole thing down a bit because, they're a different character of people and a different, and maybe people think that about Dave when he goes to Russia as well, I don't know. You know, that we preach kind of Sunday school messages to everybody except the Christians in the West because they're Africans and because they're first generation believers and because of this and that and the other. And because we get the impression sometimes from dear well-meaning missionaries who are involved in different aspects of work. Sometimes we focus on humanitarian work and container work and all that kind of thing, and we get the impression that everybody in Africa is impoverished and everybody in Africa is simple and everybody in Africa is holding out their hand. These subjects, the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven and their relevance for us today, was requested by that assembly. And before I finished that trip in March, they actually asked me to come back and fit in an extra week at the end of the trip that wasn't planned, and to speak, if you please, on the present position of Israel in the purposes of God. And I spent a whole weekend, not a week, a whole weekend, but in Africa you can have a week's meetings and a weekend without any trouble. They're quite happy to come to the hall and stay for 2 hours at a time, get tea break and stay for another 2 hours, and get some lunch and stay for another two. There was one occasion in Francistown where I preached. And I mean, David stood up and talked. I don't mean I went to meetings. I preached for 23 hours out of 48. I think that's a record. It certainly is a record for me. Anyway, we moved on from the meetings in Francistown. They were well attended. Typically out there nowadays, what has been happening, and I think this is very relevant. I've seen a lot of this in Africa in my recent visits. Not only sinners coming in to hear the gospel, because that is a specific target in gospel meetings, but in ministry and teaching meetings, especially specific, systematic, topical, advertised ministry. They've got the idea that you propagate your teaching meetings the same as you propagate your gospel campaigns.
And they expect Christians from denominations who are not exposed to the whole of the truth of God to come to the gospel hall to listen to teaching. They don't come with a negative attitude. So the Pentecostals and the Baptists, and maybe even some from the Anglican Church in Africa, if you have topics and subjects and it's advertised, you know, the people who come in to listen, that's most encouraging. And from time to time, you will get souls who will come towards the light. And there have been cases where souls have gradually, not just in a huge jump, not falling out with the people they left, not taking a political position, but following the exposition of the truth and the illumination of the Word of God and finishing up in the assembly. I'm reading here on Friday, and we're going to open up for a week's meetings in the little assembly down there in Washington. Now, the last time I was there last year, they said the assembly is increased by another 2. I said, well, where did those 2 come from? Are they new converts or what have they? They said, no, brother, they moved sideways from the Baptist Church. Now, you're talking a very small rural farming community. I said, did that cause any kind of ill feeling? He said, no, brother, we went and spoke to the elders in the Baptist Church and said these people wanted to come to us by conviction. And they said the elders in the Baptist Church said if it was by conviction there was no difficulty and there would be no falling out. He told me that in the house before I went to the meeting, so I was looking for these 2 young people who had come from the Baptist Church. I was astonished to find 13 other members of the Baptist Church in the ministry meeting. They told me there was 9 breaking bread on a Sunday morning. I think there was 24 the first night I was there. I said, how do you go from 9 to 24? They said, everybody else is from the Baptist. And that was only 6 months after 2 had left the Baptist Church and came into fellowship in the assembly. That says a lot about the 2 who came, about the elders of the assembly who received. And listen, brethren and sisters, about the spiritual decency of the men who reside in the place they came from. That's a unity of testimony. It's not ecumenism, but it's a unity of Christian and gospel testimony in Little Village. And God can bless that. And we have seen in recent days that same kind of activity in Africa. We better keep moving because you don't want to look at Land Rover pictures. My wife doesn't like me talking about my Land Rover, you see. She thinks it's a bit of a sort of almost an icon. Not really. I mean, when it's got 600,000 at the club, it's worth about $1,000. But at least when you're showing pictures, it creeps in. You meet all kinds of beasts on the road in Africa. These are actually open cast mine trucks, not this here. This is the truck that's carrying this. So the things are so big, it takes one truck to carry, that's just the tipper, and then another truck to carry the chassis, and then a third truck to carry the cab. When you meet this whole thing coming down the road, you just ride in the bush, because they take the whole road up. And you see all kinds of things. That was the ambient temperature the day we were riding north, 47.5, which wasn't extreme. And then we moved about another 200-300 kilometres. This is Brother Dan. He's now driving it. Don't have time to tell Dan's own story. No, we'd be here at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever. I've worked with Dan for about 20 years. My dear brother, driving in the Land Rover last September, he took a very severe stroke. He brought it on himself by overwork and by excess activity. And he took a stroke driving and finished up part of the skew at the side of the road and people came to offer him help. He convinced them it was crap and tiredness and said he would try and drive to the private hospital, which is owned by a doctor friend of mine, a fellow brother of both of us. He drove 160 kilometres with only the use of one hand and one foot, just with willpower and the grace of God. And when he arrived at Dr. Monplady's clinic at 6 o'clock in the morning, he passed out. And they came inside and said, there's a man who's passed out in the ambulance bay. We'd better bring him in. But they brought him inside and they sent for the doctor, and the doctor realized it's my friend Dan. By that stage, he was unconscious. He took his blood pressure and all his other vitals, and his blood pressure, if I remember it right, was 295/100. Dr. Monpally told me, he said, Dan should have died. He was in a coma for 5 days. And he said, his heart has been distended because of the extent of the beating. What it was on the road, I have no idea. Now today you would know that he hadn't been well. He's on very heavy medication. But you would never know the man. Now there's a weakness in his left eye, so when he's driving and he gets a little bit tired, he's got a tendency to, well, he would go over the hedge if he didn't, you know. But anyway, the rest of him seems to have recovered tremendously well. Dr. Monpally told me in October, he said, brother, you're coming in January for meetings with us. He said, I'm not sure what will happen about Zambia. You can go solo the way you did before, but he said, Dan will not go. He said, he'll not be fit to go, and he said, I question if he'll ever drive again.
Now that was actually the 31st of January. That was only 4 months later. I was in the passenger seat and Dan was driving the Land Rover.
It was a miracle of grace, and I'll tell you this, what I'm going to tell you now for the next 15, 20 minutes, the whole of that trip was an absolute outpouring of the presence of God and the power of God and the grace of God, things that I never had seen before and probably never will again.
We got to Kasangula. If I had more time, I would tell you all about what it takes to cross a border. If you think going through the Peace Arch on a day when you hit a dear soul from the Department of Home Affairs,
you know, you can hit or hurry in arrival his wife before he came on ship, and they can be stopped. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, you can come back the other way and find a Canadian person on that side, and he's also obstructive.
But these guys here, they're professionals when it comes to obstructiveness.
Dan and I have been through that border. It's the Zambezi River, it's the pontoon crossing,
it's the customs clearance, and it's also the border between Botswana and Zambia. Now, I've been through it, if I said 100 times, I wouldn't be exaggerating.
Dan has been through it more than that, but he's a Zambian national.
And we know most of the naughty boys by sight.
And we know most of the dodges they're trying to work off by heart. It took the two of us, both working flat out and watching each other's backs.
It took the two of us 3.5 hours to get the right amount of paperwork stamped in the right places to get the two of us and the Land Rover out of that compound. And I mean, that's 3.5 hours each, so that's 7 hours of a working day shared between two men. It's not unknown to actually have to sleep in your vehicle in that compound because you can't exit in the working day in which you arrive.
So it's no surprise that a lot of people don't want to travel around in Africa. That's us coming over onto the Zambian side. It is ramshackle. Usually one of these pontoons has an accident near in the basis. I mean, you're crossing the fourth largest river in Africa. The Victoria Falls that Livingstone discovered in 1850 or something is about 50 kilometres down here. So if one of these things breaks and goes sailing down the river, it hasn't happened yet. But I mean, they overturn quite regularly. They break down quite regularly. Mishaps come between the trucks going on too soon and this guy not having his engine in gear and slipping out. The day that we came back, there was a guy who drove his lorry. He missed for some reason, whatever. Happens regularly, drove into the river. And before they could get the thing stopped and pulled out again, the fellow drowned behind his steering wheel. And then the police are involved and the lorry sits there and they drain all the water out. And then it goes on a regular basis. You need the preservation of God when you go to travel. Traveling in this country, distances are vast, but I tell you this, traveling in this country is a blessing. It really is. I mean, you can stop anywhere you want for a cup of coffee and go to the bathroom. I mean, a cup of coffee in Zambia is as rare as a giraffe in British Columbia. You know, and a clean washroom, well, that'd be as rare as rhinoceros walking down West Side Road, you know. I mean, you're blessed. So travelling in the is not a hardship. And I go home to Ireland and they say, oh brother, you know, how many thousand kilometres? I say, don't talk about it. Because where I came from, this is heaven, this is easy. You know, I'm not saying the work is easy, but the travel is a cakewalk compared to some of this stuff here. Now, that's the list of assemblies that we actually visited in 5 weeks. The dear brother in front of you, who has got his own difficulties inside, and the dear brother Dan, who was with me, who's got his difficulties as well, and an old Land Rover that's been rebuilt more than once, and it's got 600,000 in the club. We visited the assembly in Livingstone, Avondale in Lusaka, East Road in Lusaka, Itawa in Ndola, Luansha Kalalushi, Nkana in Kitwe, Chulalabongwe, Loloma, Solwezi Valley, Solwezi New Assembly, and Chitokoloki. We visited all of that in 5 weeks. The number of times that we preached, and also kind of the number of people that we preached to was beyond calculation. We arrived in Lusaka. Here's a lovely story. We arrived in Lusaka on a Monday evening, expecting to go and preach in the new house assembly, in full fellowship with this assembly, outreach work in a district. One or two people get saved. Do you take them 45 minutes right across the city to a gospel hall that their neighbours don't know where they're even home to go to?
Well, there's one or two or three, yes.
But when you get there's enough, a little nucleus, then the brethren here wisely said, you know what, these people have got saved in that district, they live in that district, they should be baptized in that district, and we should have a little testimony in that district. Now this dear brother here, Benjamin Chandalala, who's half Zambian and half Congolese, has been on oversight in this assembly for maybe 30 years. And he said, I'm willing to step down from oversight.
I'm willing to go and be the shepherd of this little new fledgling assembly, and I'm willing to have the assembly on Sunday, and the prayer meeting, and the Bible study, and the gospel meeting, and feed the saints in my house 4 times a week until we get to the stage where the assembly is large enough to get a second bill of all.
See, that's grace. That's humility.
Well, you see, he ceased to be the elder here, he became the pastor there. No,
you're mistaken the character of the man. He's a humble soul.
And he was so excited. I've known Ben for years, and he was so excited that Dan and I, you know, Dan hadn't preached in his homeland for years. He's a Zambian. And him and I have traveled in different parts of Zambia, but usually outreach work. So to go and minister together in established assemblies, that was a new thing for both of us to be. I hope you recognize the guy in the middle. He's the one with the clean shoes. I nearly said the clean face. He's the one with the clean, well, no, actually, he's the one with the clean shoes. The Africans like to polish their shoes. I gave up polishing my shoes in Africa years ago. As you can see, so did Dan. I think those shoes have never been polished. But then we're not polished men. We just preach the gospel of the grace of God. We were supposed to preach in this little house, in Ben's house, and we thought we wouldn't be able to get to the main assembly gospel hall because Lusaka at that point in time was overrun with a massive cholera epidemic. The government had brought in the army to clear out the flea markets and all the other African words that I can't translate for you that represent all the kinds of markets that they have. And the government also brought in local legislation that churches could only meet for communion service because cholera is spread by poor quality hygiene. And so they said no church of any kind can gather on any weeknight, not a denominational thing. It wasn't opposition, it was simply from a hygiene point of view until we say that the epidemic has been overcome. No church can gather. Now, there's 2 points that I'm going to make. The only church gathering that continued in the city of Lusaka of 1.5 million people was this assembly here, because it's unregistered and it meets in a house. And so as far as they were concerned, it was a social family gathering. And they were exempted from the regulations if they were wisely cleaned and washed their hands. And this little assembly met 3 times a week. When every other church of every kind in Zambia and the Lusaka was not able to open the door. That's encouraging. That's encouraging. You know, I do believe, you've heard me at it before, the day could come before the Lord takes us home that we'd be happy to walk out. That such will be the restrictions of these kind of buildings, the material loss will not concern us. We just decide how many cells the assembly's breaking into, how many houses we're going to use, what size of group would be wisdom, and we'll walk out and lock the door for the last time. And I don't know what to do with it. It might not happen. But I tell you this, dear child of God, it could. You should not be hung up on the structure and the fabric and the formality of the building. That little assembly continued to gather when this one couldn't. But we crossed the border on Monday, 3.5 hours on the border. We drove the whole way up to the sack on the rest of the day. And I got a phone call from this brother here while we were driving between Livingstone and the sack. He said, the council announced on the news at lunchtime that gathering restrictions have been lifted. He said, brother, we'd love to have the first weeknight ministry meeting in the Saka Gospel Hall for 4 months. We'd love to have you and Dan there for a meeting if you can change your schedule and come on Tuesday night. And so I preached to 300 souls in the Saka Gospel Hall on the Tuesday evening, and it was the first meeting in that hall for 4 months. We left there. I'll not go into the details of this story. You can see that something went wrong inside the Land Rover here, and you can see that something went wrong outside the Land Rover here, and you can see that something went wrong with the tarmac road. It is a tarmac road. The tarmac is there underneath. That was all in the one morning, which means we arrived at Itawa Gospel Hall in Ndola. We arrived there a full hour late. That would be like me turning up now for this meeting, except that you weren't sure until now that I was coming. They just sung for a whole lot. You see, John Basenga, the brother who was standing out in the street waiting for me to arrive, he said, you know, brother, it's maybe 3-4 years since we had a visitor. We get used to listening to our own voices. You see, you know, even here, and I know when you're down in the lower mainland, Kamloops, even here, you go up, you know, the terrace and Anchorage and Grand Prairie and Port McMurray and some of the places where Dave has been and goes. I mean, I'm sure Brother Dave will confirm afterwards in the car park if you ask him. There's places he goes in a 12-month or maybe a 2-year cycle or a 3-year cycle. And they'll say, Dave, nobody has been here since you were here last. The only Dave we see is Dave Richards.
And some of these places in Africa, I've been domiciled in Ireland for 4 years. And yet some of these places I preached in January, February, March this year, have not had a, I'm not saying there was no gift to the assembly. They haven't had a visiting brother since I was there last. And they'll tell you that. They'll say, brother, nobody came to encourage us. Just to let us know we're on the map. Just to let us know the body of Christ actually works. That assemblies are autonomous, but they're not isolated. And I'll tell you this, dear child of God, and don't go on holidays and forget about the assembly, for that's a wonderful encouragement. Just turn up. You don't even have to preach. You just turn up and you say, my wife and I have come to fellowship with a little company of saints. We struggled to find out who you were and where you were. We googled all over the place, but you know what? We've come with a little letter of commendation and want to share fellowship. That is a tremendous encouragement. Yes, if it's a big assembly of 300 that says, nice to see you, brother, we'll try and find you a spare chair. When there's a little assembly of 10 or a dozen, you know what? You know, an assembly of 10, that's a 20% increase. Just you and your wife turning up, just once. You know, it becomes appreciable. I was up there in Terrace. They'd nine that broke bread on Sunday morning, but we managed to get, by the middle of the week, it was 18 people came on there. So soon, brother, we've got a 200% increase in our normal crowd. How long are you staying for? I said a week. It's just the same here. Some of these places, you know, they're scarce, and men that want to go and visit and share the ministry and teach them the Word of God. I'll move on. We left there and travelled up through the Copper Belt. You go up as far as Chingola, and you can Google that on the map if you're not familiar with Zambia, and then you turn left. There's other assemblies that I'm bypassing now because we visited them on the way back. When you get up to these lovely red laterite roads, you know what, the old Land Rover, well, you know, the British military after the war and all the English people, they're blessed. That's really what they designed the old thing for. It never was meant to go anywhere on the tarmac road. It's actually more comfortable when you're in the dirt, and it actually looks better when it's dirty. And I'll not preach any more sermons about Land Rovers. You could drive a thing, it's possible. You know, or some other thing, in a Sousa or something. But up there, a Land Rover just works. Anyway, we came to Solways. Dear Margaret nearly spoke out in the meeting and nearly had to sign as a sister, Margaret the Cuckoo, last Sunday, because she wanted to shout out and say, this is my home street and it's tarmac. And she told me that afterwards. She said, Dave, the tarmac to Main Street. I said, I know, sister. Here's a Margaret the Cuckoo, Whitney's wife, was an Angolan refugee who was in a semi-prison camp outside this town. And so basically, my first contact with Africa more than 20 years ago was refugee prison camps in Zambia. Our assembly supplying humanitarian stuff and containers there. My first trip to Africa was to go to visit in a refugee camp in Angola. 30,000 people, it was more a prison than a camp. And dear Margaret, she wasn't the cuckoo to her own name, she got saved through Pentecostal outreach as a 14-year-old teenager in a refugee camp in Solways. She got a temporary permit to come out to get education, she finished her education, she got some degree of citizenship, and eventually she came across by degrees and the long story, she finished up in Canada. And she met a young man in Vancouver, somebody said to her, there's a man from your own country, because they presumed she was a Zambian, and she met Whitney and he wasn't saved. And she led him to Christ. And today they're both up there in the little assembly in Paris. Isn't that amazing? An Angolan refugee saved at 14 through Pentecostal outreach in a prison camp. And she and her husband are in fellowship in the assembly in Paris. I tell you, God knows no boundaries. And the work of God knows no bounds. She was so excited to see her home street so raised. We preached down in the valley. Now the valley is a very interesting assembly. It was planted about 32, 33 years ago. Yeah, 82, 83, by five young men. Five young men who were civil service employees who worked in the government offices in Lusaka, down there where I showed you in the earlier slide. That's about 2,000 kilometers away. Each one of them severally was sent for by their supervisors on a Monday morning. I'm sure it was a Monday morning. Those kind of things always happen on Monday mornings. And they said, you're going to get promotion. And after that, when you're told about promotion, you hold tight onto the arms of the chair, because I was a cat. They said, we're going to give you an upwards move, but a little bit sideways. You're getting a step up. But you're going to go to the new administrative center in Solwezi. Now, I'm sure most of those young men, and there was no Google in those days, they wondered where Solwezi even was. He because it was a frontier town that had grown out of a mining boom. And the government decided they should civilize it and make a government center. Five young men, there was 500. But I'm talking about five young men who were single, five young men who were not married, that's why they were sent. Five young men who were from an assembly background. I'm not even sure all of them had been in fellowship, but five young men from an assembly background. And they found themselves inside 3 weeks on the bus, way up there, 2,000 kilometers to an opposite, probably empty and courier, to start doing a government job in a more senior position than they left in the sack of civil view. There wasn't any formal churches. There wasn't even a baptism. They said, you know what, we'll start a little prayer group. Which one of us has got the biggest room? Five of us will meet to pray on a weeknight. And then they said, you know, we knock off at 12 o'clock on Saturday, and so what we should do is we should go down to the main street that was in the previous picture. We should preach in the main street, the five of us will support each other. And inside 6 months of preaching in the main street, a young man called Peter Malenga, who was another young man sent on the same basis from the Saga way up to Solvezi with an engineering job, but no background whatsoever, friendly with these young men. But through their open air preaching on the street on Saturday, Peter Malenga trusted Christ. Inside a year, there was 12. And the 13th who joined him, he was already saved and baptized, but he came into Solvezi because his uncle said he would pay for a better quality education for him. And so a young man, about 18 or 19, his name was Dan, he came in and he was the 13th. And he arrived just at the time when they were deciding that they were looking to the Lord for wisdom to set up a little table and to break bread and start a little testimony. And so Dan was there the first Sunday they broke bread. And so basically, I know every one of those original elders personally as deep friends. And you know, it took them a long time to get to this stage. It took them about 10 years to build that wall because they had no connection with mission stations. They looked to the Lord, they depended on what they could lay aside themselves, and it took them 10 years to put a roof on their wall, and another 2 years to get electricity inside, another 2 years to get sewage to run and water. Now they've got classrooms and they can make lunch and all the rest of it. They put in new windows, and they repaired some cracks, that's why it's not fully painted. They're in the middle of repainting after installing new windows and what have you. There's about 100 breaking bread there on the Sunday, and we were there for a week of ministry and gospel combined on end times with one of my old charts. On the Tuesday night, in fact, the night that I took that photograph, Dan preached there on the Lord's Day morning. It was the first time he preached since his illness. It was the first time he stood on his feet before an audience and preached the gospel, and his doctor said he'd never preach again. I sat in the seat with the tears running down my face, and he preached on, they that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. He said, I was in denial. He said, the man on the street said to me, you've had a stroke. I said, I've had a cramp. He said, I nearly broke myself into eternity and other people as well, God was gracious. Because he said, I denied the severity of my illness. And he said, there's people sitting in this room and you're driving yourself into eternity because you don't realize the severity of your illness. It's worse than a stroke. It's going to take you down to a lost eternity. He said, dear man, be wise and come to the only physician that can give you need. He said, I collapsed outside the clinic. He said, you don't have to collapse. He said, you just have to bow your heart in front of Christ. And I sat there with the tears pouring down my face. There was a young man sitting in that gospel meeting on Sunday morning. His name was Sammy. He'd never heard the gospel before. He came back on Monday night. He knew Monday wasn't a gospel meeting. It was Bible teaching about end times. But he came back on Monday night, and the preacher on Monday night was myself. There's always gospel, no matter what you're speaking about. The young man said, this is interesting stuff. And he came back of his own accord on Tuesday night. He came from 1,500 kilometers away from Zambezi. And he was doing a diploma in mathematics. That's why he was in Solvezi. And his family were 1,500 K away, and he had no Christian background whatsoever. He'd never heard John 3:16. And while I was preaching on the tribulation on Tuesday night, he bowed his head in his third meeting ever and trusted Christ. He came back to mind. That was good, you know, he came back. That's what you should. That's what Dave was preaching about at the conference. He came back on Wednesday. Listen now. At the end of the meeting on Wednesday night, he turned to the man beside him. He said, please, now this guy doesn't own a Bible. He said, please, can you identify for me one of the elders of your church? That's a good question, isn't it? And so the man that he was speaking to said, that brother over there is one of our elders. So Samuel got off the seat when the people were coming out and shaking hands and greeting. And he went over to Brother Max and he said, please, could I talk to a group of the elders?
Well, they didn't know what he wanted, but, you know, Max gathered up four other brethren, so five of them in the side room and shut the door. I saw a little tableau, but nobody told me anything, and I didn't ask. Because that was assembly business and local testimony business and the elder business. I was there preaching the gospel. It wasn't my business. Mm-hmm. If they wanted me to know, they would tell me. If they wanted my advice, they'd seek it privately. For me to go in there and barge in there and join them and ask what it's about, no, bro. That'd be me getting very, very far above my station. I'm the Lord's servant. And when you're here as a tool in the hand of the Lord, and you're accountable to the elders and the assembly in which you're in fellowship with locally. Triple accountability. Accountable to the Lord who sends, accountable to the assembly who commands, and accountable to the assembly you're working with. I tell you, that's a heavy word. You need to be clear about that. And so they didn't tell me what had happened, and I didn't ask. I don't know if Dan knew, but he didn't tell me. What transpired in the room was the young man told them, they said, why do you want to see us? He said, well, you know, last night at your church I trusted Jesus. He said, should I not be witnessing to the elders of what I have done? Oh, they said, that's wonderful, tell us your story. And he did. He told them a story. Now, he never heard the gospel before. He came on Sunday, Dan preached about being sick and needing to have the sin sickness restored. He said, I never heard that these dangers were coming, that judgment was coming, that the time to trust in Jesus could be shortened because the church and Christians could be removed. He said, why have I not heard this before? There is no time to delay. He said, I bowed my head and trusted in Jesus and asked for forgiveness of my sins. And so he said, I'm telling you about it. So they encouraged him and they prayed with him. They said, now Samuel, you can go. He said, no, I've got one more request. They said, what's that? He said, I'm coming back again tomorrow night. And he did. He came every night. He said, I'm coming back again tomorrow night. Please, at the end of the service, could Brother Max, who spoke to me first, could he please get up and tell the whole audience what has happened with me? He said, I stand up so they know who I am. But he said, I'm not a local and nobody knows me. He said, I want all the 150 people. He said, I want everybody to know that Samuel's different, but he's trusted in Jesus. I want to witness. And he said, I don't want to speak, but he said, I want them to tell what was transacted in me. And they didn't tell me until the end of the meeting on Thursday night. They were thanking me for coming and all the rest. They were going to sing the closing hymn, and then Max said, Samuel, will you please stand up? And the young man stood up, and he bowed over nicely as Samuel's doing, and he clapped his hands, and he turned right around, and then they told the story. Well, I was crying at the end, you know, and so was that. That was worth it, wasn't it? It was absolutely wonderful. We left there, and we moved to the Loma. I'll not tell you, well, I mean, that picture tells its own story. That's dear Wilma Geddes. She's a widow. She's Irish, so you might not know of her. She's been a missionary in Africa for more than 50 years. She had a driver because she doesn't drive anymore because she's got eyesight problems. Her driver fell asleep. He could see, but he fell asleep. And she had bad eyesight, and she was awake. But he rode the thing three times into the bush, and by the grace of God, she only sustained some broken ribs. That's the picture. I showed that picture at home, and I think some of my brethren were ashamed, because that vehicle, the day it was destroyed, was 19 years old, and she hasn't even got it to fix. Well, my uncle was 20 years old, and it's got whatever, you know. We don't worry about that. It's not about the age of the vehicle, but I'll tell you this, there are hardships and serving the Lord in some of those areas. Now, that's a better picture because this is Canada House. Oh, when you're in Ireland, that doesn't mean anything. But when you're here, I mean, that's important. Why is it called Canada House in the Loma? Because the earliest missionaries to Northwest Zambia were Canadians. I had to go to Africa to learn that. As a young, wet behind the ears Irish brother, I thought that the early missionaries in Zambia were Irish. And then I thought the ones that came next were Scottish. And then when I went out there, I discovered all these people that I'd never heard tell of, because somehow or other nobody had mentioned his name. And all the early missionaries, the pioneers away up in northwest Zambia, Chitokoloki is the oldest mission station, I'm going to get there just now. And they came out and built like an outreach centre. That house there is almost 100 years old, and dear Marion Ronald lives in that house. Some of you will know of, and some of you will know Marion. She's not well. And she lost her dearest friend on earth just over a year ago, Daisy Hamm. And Daisy could have been repatriated. It wouldn't have made her better, but it might have made her slightly more comfortable. And Daisy said, I want to die here with my friends in the Loma, and I want to be buried in the graveyard of the mission station. I understand that sentiment perfectly. There's a piece of my heart in Africa. I think you understand. There's a piece of my heart in BC. I don't deny that. And a little piece in Ireland. My heart's divided up in all kinds of bits. But the piece that's in Africa, you can't see here. It's there.
If I've got a prayer request or a need, I send the information to pray to some African folk with black faces before I'll send it to white people. I'm not ashamed to say that.
And so you can remember dear Marion Ronald. She's not very well and she's old and she's still working on a daily basis. She goes every day down there to the Loma Hospital. We had some wonderful meetings in the Loma Gospel Hall. It's a very strange looking building. I don't know who designed it. I wouldn't be too happy with the design myself, to be honest. And they're trying to patch the roof and it's not a success. And they're putting in a new ceiling because they had set the old one and the electricity wasn't working, so they took it out. The hall seats about 1,000 people. I've seen 1,000 in there at conference, but we had about 500 at those meetings. They were expecting 80, 90. They had them in the afternoon because they said, we're going to try teaching meetings in the afternoon. I said, not at night. Well, no, we've no electricity. And if we have them at night, the people who come from the villages, they can't go home in the dark because of snakes. So when I said at 2:30 in the afternoon, they should be working. No, but they'll take time off and knock off early. The meetings have been announced, they know they're coming, and so they can leave the fields, or if they're in education, they can get up a little bit early. They can take some time, their leave is flexible. If they want to come to hear the word, we don't want to turn up. We expect them about 100 every afternoon, and you and Dan will preach. Well, I think the smallest number is 4, and I think the biggest was about 550. While we were there, we got a phone call from Brother David McAdam. He's just become a little bit more famous because his home newspaper decided to write a profile on Banbridge in County Armagh in Northern Ireland. I heard about it, but I haven't been able to get my hands on the newspaper. I would love to know what they have written about this medical surgeon who's home for a little holiday from Banbridge in Ireland, who's been 30-something years operating on Africans in the jungle. David McAdam's a wonderful chap. A good friend of mine, a homeboy, as he would say, in Africa. He phoned me up on the Saturday and said, Brother, you're having a wee bit of a revival. I said, well, I don't know about that. He said, you have to come if you told the local. I said, listen, dear, it's straight up. It wasn't planned on the schedule. Loma was as far as we were meaning to go. We were trying to get to Kiongo, it's not even going to work. He said, you have to come for a one-day conference in Chitokoloki. I said, listen, David, but we're on the turnaround. We're going back next week. We said, that's fine. You can come on Wednesday. I said, but there's a meeting arranged in the Loma. He said, you can cancel it. He was quite insistent, you know. Well, of course, there was logic in the matter because we had a whole week. We were there from Saturday to Friday. And we were preaching sometimes between school and hospital and ministry. We were preaching sometimes 3 times in the one day and 2 hours in the ministry meeting with a hymn in the middle. We can sing just in the set. And so there was logic in saying, we'll take Wednesday. Wednesday is our midweek. So give them a holiday on Wednesday. It's their normal midweek, but they've been out 7 times. You drive 3 hours into Tokoloki. You can have lunch. You can be in a mini-conference in the afternoon. You'd stay overnight. You'll drive 3 hours back in the morning and you'll be on the platform again at 2 o'clock in the Loma. It's dead simple. But it was. And so we got to Tokoloki. Dan hadn't been there for 30 years. I hadn't been there for 7 years. There's the man himself. Dr. David McAdam, as Irish as ever was. This brother you know. This is Brother Dan. And this is David and his wife coming straight from the theatre. He's very seldom dressed in anything else unless he's going to meetings. That guy spends most of his working life working between 2 theatres. The number of souls he's kept out of eternity is out of his house. And he is a wonderful brother as far as assembly. It was him organised the meeting. Now, you see, I should have had this picture first and not the montage. Because they told us again, we're expecting maybe 80 to 90. They said, we had a prayer meeting and we told the Lord if we got the triple figures. I did a little handout for them and they said, we've done 100 copies. We're expecting there's 1 or 2 left over. And that if we get to 100, we will be totally gratified. We haven't had more than 30 in the hall for 5 or 6 years. Now, as you can see, there was more than 100. There was more than 200. In fact, after I took that photograph, it got worse again in the second and third session. We began at 2 o'clock and went to 7:30. With one short break for tea and 2 or 3 breaks for water in between. It was about 45 degrees outside. I didn't get into the jacket on. And we preached the 2 of us for 5.5 hours. By the last session, they had to say nobody else can get in. People wanted it. So what they did was they dismantled the PA system and they bridged it across to the hospital radio system. And they told all the people who were arriving, they don't go to the hall because you can't get in. Walk over and sit in the trees by the hospital and there's broadcast on the hospital radio. When we came out of there at 7:30, they said, Brother, did you know you were preaching to a minimum of 1,000 and possibly 1,200 people? Well, that was absolutely incredible. In the middle of that audience there, because they sent young men out with flyers to go around the community,
He said, when you find a bush church on Saturday afternoon, because the men never agreed to come, this is 3 days' notice. Then they printed a little flyer. They said, when you find a bush church, just set it inside. Some of these places might, by the grace of God, on Sunday morning announce that there will be a mini conference in the gospel hall on the mission station to Tokoloki on Wednesday. We were fishing with a long line. We might get one or two believers as well as sinners from other places. The young man, one of the young men who was running in the bush, old fashioned style with little flyers, you know, and he came to a little bush, grass hut church, he put one inside. Whether he meant to or whether he didn't know, he put it into the bush Roman Catholic church. The Roman Catholic priests sat down to read, teaching about end times and the end of the age and God's judgment on this earth. He got up on Sunday morning after Mass, and he told the audience in the bush church, he said, we don't know anything about these things. He said, if you're interested in going, please be here at midday on Wednesday. I am walking with whoever goes with me to the Brethren Church to hear these things. He arrived at 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, dressed in ordinary clothes, and he had 60 of his parishioners with him. And they sat from 2 o'clock to 7:30. They didn't tell Dan and I that until the conclusion. I was glad they did. Because you know what? The flesh could get in. And fear knows what you might have said in the flesh. We preached the gospel of the grace of God. We preached about the great whore and the scarlet woman. We preached about judgment and tribulation and the coming of the Lord. And for sure the gospel. And that dear man, 60 of his parishioners, sat and listened to 5.5 hours of preaching. The Roman Catholic, then you can come and hear, what would you do? No idea. You would give thanks to the Lord, and you would trust for great wisdom for the men who were standing up, that they wouldn't be finger pointed or throwing stones or causing offence. We moved on from there. We came to back to the Copper Belt, as I had talked about. The Copper Belt actually is a place. Not only is it the place where all the copper seams have been found, but it actually is the name of the central province in Zambia. That mixes some people up. We went to Chulalongwe. That's dear brother Dan standing. You can see the wee bars coming up, and there's a foundation in there, and those dear souls have been trying to build a hall, and they've been at that level for 2 years. And they're still meeting in a house, and they haven't been able to get out of the ground. That's not abnormal. I helped years ago to get that little hall built in Canon. We had a mini conference there. And then over here at Kalalushi, now this is a lovely picture, because this is a little assembly they used to meet in a garage. I mean a car garage, to hold 2 cars. They rented it because nobody had a car to put in the garage, so they closed up one wall, they paid some rent, they put in plastic chairs. And they've been meeting there for 20 years. They got a plot from the council, they got permission to build, they draw through some plans and then they scrapped the plans. They went back to the council and they said, can we change the plans and can we extend the site and can we build a bigger hall? The council said, why? They said, because we've been renting facilities from the council for 20 years, twice a year to have a conference. And we don't have, the assemblies don't to have a building in the Copper Belt big enough to hold a conference in. We would like and see it for an assembly to dust to build a hall big enough to seat 500. And then we'd be the caretaker assembly of the hall. You know, by the grace of God, they did. They were able to tell us they had got the roof on just before we came. They said they took us on Sunday afternoon after the meetings to the workshop to see the windows. That's the Africans. He said, well, take your tie off and roll your sleeves up. You're going to the steel foundry because we want to show that our windows have been manufactured and they're going to be installed in a week or two's time. And we're going to get the inside plastered and not the outside. We put in temporary electricity, and on the 1st of July, on the Heroes and Unity weekend, we're hoping to have the first ever conference. Mind you, that was March. And I said, you know, Charles, brother, you have great faith. Well, he said, brother, you add a little seat in prayer to our faith and trust in God. I got a message from him 2 weeks ago to say we had a wonderful 2-day conference in the hall with temporary electricity and the windows weren't glazed, but nobody cared about those things. They had a wonderful conference. We left there and we came down, back down to where Dan stays now, his home territory. I mean, that's the most evocative road sign to me because we were in Mahon, Francistown, 700 kilometres away. Zambia, where we'd been, was about 3,000 up that way. Zimbabwe, is about another 1,000 that way, you're right in the heart of Africa. We spent about a week actually giving out calendars and doing outreach work with Bushmen people. I mean the actual Bisharma people. Dan speaks 12 languages. What a character. Now, I said I would come back to Salimi Pinkwe. That's not a very recent picture. I like that picture because that was probably the last rural African picture taken of Helen before she had her diagnosis. So the picture's 5 years old, and down here is brother, not the Peter I talked about, that was Peter Malenga, Peter Marewa. Now that dear brother you talk about, that was back in my first life. And that dear brother was a clinician
in a hospital. He gave up that job and took a job as a union negotiator for the smelter, for the mining in Saudi Arabia.
The reason he did that, because there were no senior brethren in the assembly needed shepherd care and leadership. And so he moved 4 hours from Francistown to a little bush town that the sole employer of the town was a great stinking copper smelter.
I was thinking about these things when I was up in some of those towns, way up there in the northwest, down to Kitimat, and looking at that great massive big Alcan plant, but it's not Alcan now, they went and flogged it with the Argentinians or something.
And then they're going to build a liquefied natural gas plant. They're telling me there'll be 5,000 people working in the construction.
Here's a mission fee.
5,000 families coming for 5 years.
I wonder, will anybody go in a steel container and preach the gospel in the workers' camp in Kitimat?
That's in my mind, you know. I wonder when they have a church, when they have a place of worship. They're building temporary houses for 5,000 families. Now those who have means and contacts still get real houses in Kitimat. But they're building a town out of steel houses for people to come for. And of course they'll come for 5 years contract and hope it goes loads and all the rest. And it'll take 8 or 9, it probably will.
And then after it's finished and the gas is flowing and the production's done and goes to the houses, all those people will be retrenched, as they say in Africa, and go somewhere else. Mind you, 8 years is a long time. 8 years is long enough to see your whole family saved. You were exposed to the gospel and far less.
Now think about that, keep it in mind, because the way up there, you say, where is Kitimat? Well, you say, I know, if you don't know. And the way up there, I was looking at the site. And I said that to Brother Whitney. I said, you know, Brother, only God knows what opportunities in the years that were coming behind that barbed wire fence.
And dear Peter Mareva, he gave up his job and he took on a very poor, not as good a job when he went down there, and he has been an absolute stalwart in that little scheme.
And the reason I talked about Kitimat and up there is because in November last year, the government in its great wisdom in Botswana, the governments are always wise, aren't they, in their own hands, they closed down the smelter. They said there wasn't enough copper. Now let me tell you, the copper trade in Africa never was dead. They closed down the smelter totally. They're decommissioning the place. And 4,000 men were put out of work in one morning. The town collapsed. Peter has had not a cent to his name since last November. And I went down there in the month of March especially. I had a bond to go down and stay in his house. He could barely put food on the table. He's got a 30-year-old motor car. He can hardly put gas. And I said, Peter, you could go to Francistown tomorrow and get a job. He said, I could, but I don't want to leave this town. He said, Brother, just pray that with my wife's part-time job or something, that I can stay here and shepherd and care for the little assembly down there. You know, I'll tell you a story I shouldn't tell, but time's gone. My dear brother and sister, I was speaking about Peter recently in a report meeting back home. My dear brother and sister came to me and said, could we send Peter some fellowship? I said, Brother, my names in Africa are many, but I said, I've actually no idea. I'm not even sure the brother is a man. I could send it to somebody else, I could send it to him, whatever. And they said, well, brother, you know, we would love to help. In fact, they said, if we send you a little bit through time, could you somehow go and get it through? And they did send me a little bit, and I put it in a reserve account that I used for overseas stuff, and I said to my wife, what am I going to do? She said, I have no idea. If you were going, you could get the cash and get it through. She said, you can't post the money. She said, I honestly don't know what you'd do with any of it. I got an email from an assembly, I'm not telling you where, I got an email from an assembly in Africa. While I was here, in Canada. And they said, Brother, we have been exercised since you were here in the early part of the year to a fellowship with you. How can we send you the money? I said, Brother, I'm in Canada. I said, don't send me the money. And they told me what the figure was that they had set aside. And it was more than what this other couple had sent me. It was in my overseas account. I said, Brethren, if you can get the money. Well, they said, that's no problem. We can take it to a visit. I said, if you can get the money to that, brother, I can tell people back in Ireland that God doubled what they gave. And gave the money in cash into his hand. I mean, you know, Dave understands what I'm saying. God works like that. No credit to me, because I kept the little that they had given. It wasn't for me wondering how I could give it to him. But while I was praying about it, God worked and doubled the money in the same currency in Africa. It was inside the same government.
The money didn't have to go through Forex or Western Union. A brother put it in an envelope and took it down to him and said, this gift has been sent to you from two people you don't know in Ireland. That's how my God works. He meets the need in unexpected ways at times when it's least expected.
We better conclude. I could say a whole lot about calendar work, but I'll not say any more about that. My wife and I, out of our exercise in our own pocket, have been printing poster calendars in Africa for, well, the last 15 years or so. We maybe lost one year when she wasn't well. We got it going again last year. Dan and I gave out 35,000 calendars on our journey. And that's my hat that he's wearing, by the way. But anyway, he never gave it back. He is an African, a true African. He said, brother, I have a need. And he said, you're a white man, you can find another hat, but I can't even afford one. So he said, I borrow your good hat and you can buy a cheap one. I just thought it was the sun for your head. I said, I've more need than you. No, 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 he said, brother, you have less need of the sun, but I've more need of the hat. And you see, he took my hat and there, it suits him actually. It suits him. It's a bush hat. He just loves calendar work. And so we're planning in the Lord's will to print calendars again for Dan and for Evaristo and other people that I haven't talked about. Now, before I said you send you home, I would just say a couple of slides up here because I'm going here immediately after I leave here. Well, down to Okanagan, back up to West Bank for the conference, home for a day or two to wash my shirts and see my father and my wife and my family, and then up here to the Orkneys. 22,000 people in the Orkney Islands, 23,000 in the Shetlands farther east, and about 22,000 in the Hebrides further west. Five assemblies in the Orkneys, five in the Shetlands, one in the Hebrides, and one up here in the north of Scotland. So when you get to Tull Scotland, you start to get maybe not the same distance, but the same kind of isolation between assemblies as you get here. I could tell you some lovely stories, but time is gone. I only wanted just to touch base on that here. I was there last year for the gospel. It will be ministry I'm going for this time on the Orkney mainland, the largest island, and I had students come in and took days off from university. We visited 5,500 houses. We ran a little media campaign that 2,800 people responded to, and 250 followed the link and listened to an audio gospel. That was absolutely incredible. We had Satan worshippers who came in and sat in the gospel meeting. We know they were Satan worshippers because they pulled the brother at the door. He ran into the prayer meeting and brought me out. He wanted to know should he let them in or not, or he wanted to know should he run out or not. I said, brother, calm yourself down. I said, it doesn't matter. And I said, what did they tell you? Well, he said, they told me they worship Satan and they wanted me to know that, but was it okay to come in? He said, we're not atheists, they don't believe in anything. We believe in the spirit world and we want to listen to what the man has to say. They behaved most respectfully. What they thought, I don't know. I didn't get into conversation. I could tell you other stories about the work up there. Let me finish. Because when you go into the very small islands, away up the top, you get, you know, a gospel hall which is twice the size of a small sedan car and an aeroplane that holds six people and a fire engine that size, you know. Some people in Canada nearly start to think they're photoshopping the pictures, you know. But you actually can't have a gospel hall that's 20 feet long. There's 80 people live in that island. There are 10 fellowship in the assembly. And I've seen a quarter of the population of the island outside that island hall. I was preaching there in November last year. And a young man was forced by his parents, a young man of just turning 16, about to leave school, a man big, forced by his parents to come and sit at the back of a ministry meeting. I was speaking on Revelation 2 and 3, that's what they'd asked me to speak about the same church. And what was in it for him, I wasn't sure, but I was going to make sure that a little bit of gospel. And he came and sat at the back, and he had a face on him that he wanted me to know he didn't want to be there. He didn't bring a Bible, he hadn't even changed his t-shirt, it was dirty. With his work dirt on the grease on it, he lay against the wall, he went to sleep. That's right, I didn't button hold him or look at him or point at him. I left him in the Lord's hands. Halfway through the meeting, the Spirit of God spoke to him. What I said, I had no idea, that was wrong. The Spirit of God spoke to him and awakened the young man up, because that was patently obvious. He wakened up and sat up. And he never took his eyes off me until the meeting concluded, and I tell you, there was plenty gospel in the second half. He went out while I was praying, he didn't stay for him, he didn't shake hands at the door. When his parents got to the house was only about 200 metres from the gospel hall, and the grandfather's house was 100 metres the other way. It's a small island, 7 kilometres long by 1 kilometre wide. When his parents got home, he was already in bed with his family with Leica. The mother said to the father, he's in some hump today. The father said, that moment. And they went to bed. The father's a fisherman and rises at 5 a.m. He went to bed and turned their light.
I was staying with the grandparents. We were just about to get into bed, 10:15.
At 10:15, a young man came down over to his parents' bed and put the light on. He said, "What's wrong, son?" He said, "I can't wait until the morning." He said, "5 minutes ago, the first of Christmas." You know, they couldn't wait until the morning. They had to phone their granny. And the granny was in the next house, and the granny was deaf, and I was staying with him, and I'm deaf. And he's got a little bit of dementia. And the granny's out on the phone in the hall, and he says, "Nobody phones your house! Nobody phones your house at 10 o'clock at night! What's the problem?" And he says, "I can't even vote because I'm not at CO." He says, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Alan, I don't know. Does that need translated?" I said, "Alan, I don't know what's wrong. Wait until Elizabeth comes off the phone." He says, "Mom, she's greeting. She's greeting on the phone." He says, "There's something wrong." She was crying. She was weeping. Well, she came off the phone. She was greeting more. She says, "Elizabeth, what's wrong? What's wrong?" "Oh," she says, "Alan, there's nothing wrong." She says, "There's nothing wrong. She says, Sandra's got tears in her hair." I'll tell you this, the lights were on in both houses, and they didn't want to go to bed. And his father stood up, I'll speak to him when I'm finished. His father stood up the next night. Big Douglas, great big lump of a fisherman. He stood up the next night to open the meeting for me. He said, "I want to tell you something special." He said, "There's more Christians on this island than on the island." He said, "There's more Christians in this hall than there are yesterday." And then he started to be crying. He says, "There's more Christians in my house than there was yesterday." And he said, "The young man was sitting with a clean shirt on and a Bible in the road." What a change in 24 hours. You see, brothers, in a gospel campaign, no, but the gospel should be in everything. And the gospel should be in every activity. If I went to Ireland, I'm not going to go to Ireland, for time is long gone. I could tell you about a young lady called Tara. In the month of September last year, when I was showing slides of Canada, not Africa, slides of Canada. And the lights were off, and the only light was the light of the screen. She trusted Christ and a missionary before me. I tell you, I have been blessed to see one through some wonderful things. And some wonderful cases in the last few months, and I'm trusting to the Lord of his heart to see him do wonderful things more, not exclude this little town, this little district.